As you can see, I asked to come down from the mountain because I felt I was just a little too far removed. I feel more comfortable here like this. Maybe you'll feel more comfortable asking some questions. It's always wonderful to start with the Paschal blessing, is it not? And the Lord of creation has decided to remind us of that Paschal blessing all day long, I understand. So we will still be working in these conditions, I guess, for the next day or so. Last night, we talked a little bit about the devotional life and how its privatization has perhaps hindered the ritual life of the parish outside of the Eucharist. And I began to get into that distinction between secondary and primary theology and took a little excursion into ritual. Just a parenthetical statement before I begin. In terms of primary theology, we have now had two opportunities to do primary theology together. And it's always remarkable to me when I do these conferences. You know, you get a theme and kind of everybody goes in their own direction. And I mean, I had not seen the primary theology. I had not seen the hymnody. I didn't know what was going to happen last night or this morning. One of the themes that I will be coming to tomorrow is the new creation and how that is fundamental to the rhythm of the liturgy of the hours. And I think you can see in at least three of the hymns, and certainly in the canticles that we normally sing, but especially the hymn at the Paschal blessing, how beautiful that theme comes through. So, if you haven't caught that theme, I'm sure you have. If you haven't, let's see what happens this evening and tomorrow morning if we continue to accent that. I had concluded by giving you a definition of ritual, and I want to back up a little bit because of the time I didn't develop these lobes of perception, and I'd like to do that a little bit and then move into that definition and reflect a little bit about ritual itself. If you remember, I had you imagine drawing two overlapping circles, and there would be three areas in those circles. One on the far side would be the plus area or the sacred area. That would be defined by, if you were to think of an attribute of that area, it would be defined by clean or faith, the clean, the holy, the sacred. And then on the other extreme, there would be the minus, that would be the profane, the unclean. And the attribute, if faith is on one side, the attribute on the other would be anomi, or complete neutrality. And in the middle is that lived area, that mixed area, that in-betwixt and in-between, that place where we live, where we have our being. The plus area, as sacred space, is, at least in Christian terms, oftentimes described as heaven, or as paradise, or that complete, total experience of God. Of course, in this side of heaven, we don't ever have a pure experience of that. Likewise, on the other side, which would be hell, or a complete experience of a evil, satanic world. What we experience is that in-betwixt and in-between, where we have that mix. And we certainly have many ways of describing that. As Lutherans, we describe it that we are simultaneously saint and sinner in this area, the simul justus et peccator. And we experience a duality that is sometimes very subtle. Many of you know that in satanic worship, for example, it's simply saying backwards the divine service. The one place you won't find creative liturgy, for example, is in a satanic service. It's creative in that it's done backwards, but they're not going to change the liturgy at all. I mean, they're going to say the prayers and the texts exactly as they are written, except completely the opposite. Two of our students have written a book on the cults for Erdmann's. It's an encyclopedia, kind of a handbook, big thick thing, and it's quite impressive. They also did something for police officers to help them with satanic crimes. And when he's a good friend now, Larry Nichols, that lives out in New England, when he sent me a complimentary copy, in the center is the Black Mass. And he said, you've got to read it, but when you read it, hold a crucifix, have your hymnal and your Bible, because he said it'll unnerve you to see it. And it did. It did. And I was shocked at how closely tied it was to what we would call traditional historic liturgy. Certainly, there are different ways of describing this in literature and in scripture. On the plus side, it is always described in the language of paradise. It's this fertile, overflowing, abundant place. The minus is a desert. It's chaos to the point where there is nothingness. And that's sometimes hard for us to think of evil as being nothingness. But oftentimes that's the way it appears. And really what the minus is characterized by is no points of reference, where one is completely and totally without any kind of sense of there being any reference points. For example, total darkness is a wonderful picture of complete evil, because there is no orientation in that. I mean, you just don't know where you are, so that the panic from being in just complete, total dark neutrality is overwhelming. I have experienced that once in my life, and it was when I was staying at someone's house. I'll never forget it as long as I live. We were with our three children. We were in the basement of someone's home where it was completely dark and the lights went out. We were in New Hampshire. It was absolutely one of those nights where there was no light at all. We had windows, but we could not see a thing. And one of our children cried, and we both got up, and we were completely disoriented. We had forgotten where we were. We couldn't see a thing. And both my wife and I had that, you know, that feeling of panic. And it was because of total darkness. Some of these anthropologists suggest this is the reason why snakes are considered examples of the minus. Nothing feels like a snake. I mean, there's no touch points with reality there. It's something that you don't normally feel. And that's why it is such a good example of that. The other good example is when you fall. If you fall, you know how you've lost your balance, you've lost your sense of being, you know, in a place where you have control. And it's a horrible feeling. You just totally panic. Which is one of the reasons why we call the experience we have when we come to enjoy the company of another person's of the opposite sex, you know, we call that falling in love. You lose all detachment. You lose all, you know, sense of reality when you fall in love. It's a completely, totally unnerving experience. And that is one of the reasons why I think they use that expression. There are certainly lots of other examples I could give, but I think you get the point. The reason why I'm trying to paint these pictures briefly is to basically focus on that middle area, that secular area, that lived area, that place in the world that you and I inhabit. Romans 7, St. Paul's words there, is the classic statement on the nature of the secular, that mixed area. If faith and anomi are the two extremes, common sense is the attribute of the middle section. That's how we become able to cope in the world. That's how we can live in a socialized environment, is through the use of our logic and our common sense. Socialization is what makes us human beings. And a human being without socialization is less than human. One of the things that our human rituals do is help us organize that common sense in a way that we can survive in this middle area. One of the classic examples of the lived area is marriage. Marriage is an example of the mix, and how you have these two different things coming together into a unity. And one of the things that we as Christians always maintain is that there is within marriage and our perception of marriage a magnificent manifestation of the relationship between Christ and His church. Now you have these two different sexes coming together, two different ways of ordering reality. They come together in a unity, and what is it that allows them to live together in harmony and peace and love? It is because they are bound together by this outside force, this declaration from God that they are in Christ and that the two people are joined together in him. So that the relationship there is between Christ and his church, and that relationship, as you know, is one in which the Christ gives up his life for his bride, the bridegroom for the bride. And that expression of love is most clearly seen in marriage through the forgiveness of sins. Those of you who are married know that you cannot survive without that. And when that is in perfect harmony, which it sometimes is, bridegroom and bride, then that is a glimpse in this mixed life of heaven itself. Now, I bet you probably never thought of marriage as a foretaste of heaven, but that is exactly what it is. Because there you see the relationship between Christ and his church coming together and demonstrating itself in the world. That's why when two people become married within the church, they become icons for the gospel. They are getting married so that they might manifest this gospel to the world. And that's one of the reasons why marriage and the rite of marriage, the ritual of marriage, is such an important rite in the Christian church. And really, it's an important rite in any culture, because that's how culture orders itself. And the rituals of marriage, the rituals of death, the rituals of these rites of passage between one status and another, are times when we see people moving through an extraordinary change in their life. And whenever there is that movement where you're separated out of one world and are entering and being reincorporated into another, there's always that transition period. And that transition period is one in which you're crossing a boundary. You're moving from one status to another. And that's always a time of anxiety. That's always a time when you feel somewhat at sea. That's a time when you have this sense of falling. And the way in which you survive through those times is through ritual. I know whenever I did a marriage in the parish, you know, people seem to lose their minds. I mean, they just seem to be totally unglued. And, you know, they had an awful lot on their minds, but it was one of those things that was just, there were so many details, there were so many, and it was just the emotional trauma of going through such an experience. And I hope I put them at ease that when it came to the rite of marriage, I said, don't worry, I'm in charge here. Just listen to the words. Just follow me, and I'll tell you what to say, I'll tell you what to do, and just let the rite itself guide you through. And I always found that to be a very comforting thing. And certainly the rite of marriage, as many of us received it through the Anglican Church, which is the premier kind of text for Protestant wedding services, that text is of great comfort to people because it does have that wonderful rhythm. And as soon as people hear, you know, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do us part, there's a calm that comes over them. And they can speak those words back to one another, and that ritual is what helps them through that time. In fact, in my experience with weddings, the most calm, peaceful time was at those moments of the vows, where you could see very clearly that everything comes to a halt, because now they are in the hands of God, essentially, and they are moving through that very critical moment from one status to another by means of ritual. What I'm talking about when I'm talking about this lived area is I'm talking about that in betwixt and in between, that time when there is always transactions going on. There's all kinds of stuff that's happening. You're constantly negotiating. And the way in which we survive those kinds of negotiations is by means of ritual. Now, if you go back to that definition I gave you, a pattern of formal, repetitive behavior. So this is not something that we just simply think up on the way there. This is something that is there. It has form, is what it means. It is form that has been hammered out, handed down, that others have found to be helpful in this particular time. And it is repetitive, not in a kind of mantra sense necessarily, but it's something that we have done before, we have expectations of doing again, and we know that when we do it, it brings to remembrance a whole world that goes before us. It communicates meaning symbolically. That means it's open to interpretation. Rituals are rich. And by rich, I mean that they have many different ways of being seen by people. They are filled with image and metaphor and symbol. They're not you know, kind of straightforward one meaning. They're not signs, as many anthropologists would say. A sign like a stop sign, you know, a stop sign, there's nothing ambiguous about a stop sign. When you pull up to a stop sign, you don't look at the stop sign and say, well, I wonder what that means. You know, let's talk about it and let's discuss what the possible ramifications of this are. I mean, you do one thing, you stop. There's no other possibility there. I mean, that's true of a red light as well. Although, I always like to tell the funny story, I wish I had been there. When my father was visiting Istanbul, they were driving driving into the city on a bus. And he noticed how, as they were driving along, the man went through the red lights and he stopped at all the green lights. And I mean, it was exactly the order of ours, but they did just the opposite. And he watched this, and he watched this, and he watched this. And finally he said to the driver, he said, you know, this is extraordinary. You do it exactly the opposite of what we do. You know, we stop at red and go at green. And the bus driver said, oh no, that's the way it's supposed to be in this country. But everybody goes through the red. We know we have to stop at the green. So they just totally reversed it, and it still worked out fine. But I mean, there was a ritual where somebody did reinterpret, but then it turned into another ritual that accomplished the same purpose. A stop sign is, as I said, a sign, whereas a symbol is like the symbol on the altar in the chapel. It is filled with all kinds of meaning. There's not one meaning there. You have the lamb, he's got the conquering, you know, staff. Clearly, in this particular lamb, it looks like he is the conquering lion of Judah. There are others that you will see, though, that have that imagery, as well as the cut in the side of the lamb and the blood flowing out into a chalice. I mean, there you look at that, and there are all kinds of things that come into your mind. There's not one meaning. It's not that there are contradictory meanings, but there are all kinds of things that happen to you. This is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. It's the conquering Lamb. It's the Lamb who gives His blood to us in the Eucharist. I always love to use the example of an icon that a student gave me a number of years ago. And it has totally changed the way in which I think of Jesus as the vine and we are the branches. Because it's a picture of Jesus who is leaning back and just kind of gently sitting on what looks like a table and a tomb. It's got a kind of a twofold imagery there. And coming right out of his side where the water and the blood flowed, and you can see the marks in his hands, so it's post-resurrection. Out of the side of where the water and the blood flowed is a vine growing. And the vine is growing, it's a big, thick vine that wraps around him and wraps around a cross that is behind him and behind the table, and it ends up in his hands in grapes, and he is squeezing the grapes into a chalice. Now, I mean, when I look at that icon, I mean, all kinds of things come into my mind. First of all, I'll never read that text from John the same again after that. It's extraordinary. But it is a symbol, it is a metaphor in which my mind has room to move. It is allowing me to engage my whole being, not just my surface memory, but my deep memory as well, where faith and conversion takes place. And I am in this symbol, which is a kind of ritual. I am lifted up on a new level, and I have all kinds of things that happen to me as I look at that. This is one of the things that ritual does. It communicates symbolically, both verbally and non-verbally. I think I've already described that, as you certainly know as well. Verbally in terms of words, but also in terms of symbol. And I think one of the things that you have to speak here is the most powerful non-verbal form of communication is music. I mean, it is an extraordinary way of communicating, especially when it has a verbal character to it, but then is not used with the words. I find that to be one of the most powerful ways in which I am moved within the liturgy. My cantor back at St. Paul's in Fort Wayne, after the distribution and all the hymns are done, he improvises. And I know that he thinks very carefully in terms of the theme of the day and the preaching and the text and all that, about what usually a hymn he's going to improvise on. Now, there's no words here. It's just music. But what happens to many of us who are listening and who are paying attention to what hymn he's doing is that as we hear the music, we recall the texts, and we actually, at the end of the whole liturgy, after everything is said and done and we've received the sacrament, we then almost proclaim to ourselves internally by means of this music and the language that we know is associated with that music, a whole new sermon. And it is an extraordinary way of concluding the liturgy, for me at least. Every Sunday, I yearn for that moment of improvisation. And I always am sad when the hymns go too long, because I don't have that opportunity to reflect with him on this. And he knows that we do this, so he's very careful about how he chooses these things. And it is an extraordinary moment. In many ways, it is the most moving moment of the liturgy for me, because it is the icing on the cake, and it is a non-verbal and yet incredibly poignant way of bringing to completion the themes of the day. Meanings which are necessary for group relationships to operate. Anthropologists will tell you that the premier way in which you form community is by means of ritual. If you have the same rituals and people believe in them, then there will be community. And I mean, here we need to just open our eyes to the history of the church, and not just the Christian church, but certainly the church that goes back into the Old Testament, and see that those periods of time when the church, both Israel and the new Israel, were under stress, were in a hostile environment, where they were completely, totally inundated by a foreign, hostile culture, that this is the time when they are most ritualistic. This is the time when their rituals are rigid. They do not change them, because this is how they are handing down the faith. They're handing down one's understanding of the faith in the midst of an environment that's trying to dismantle that faith. Talk to the Lutherans in Russia, and they will tell you how clearly it is that they were able to preserve Lutheranism, because on the way out to Siberia after the Bolshevik Revolution, where they basically gutted the Lutheran Church, they by memory recorded the catechism, they recorded the liturgies, and that's all they used for about 70 years. I mean, that's what they had. And you can bet that they're not going to engage in any kind of, you know, creativity when this is all that they had. Now, I'm sure that they did add some things and tried to expand a little bit, but those books are still their precious documents. And when you talk to them about how they were able to maintain themselves as Lutherans for 70 years, they will tell you it was that catechism that was done on the trains and those liturgies that was able to maintain their faith. There are all kinds of examples of this. But the point is that this is how groups, you know, stay together as community. And the next one, it's not only for them to operate, and this is really what I've been talking about, that they may cohere and thus survive. Cohere and thus survive. They come together and they survive because they have this language, this ritual. There are a number of characteristics of ritual I'd like to briefly touch upon, because I think that they will be very helpful in getting a handle on what I'm trying to say. And I think you're going to see the relationship here to primary theology. And one of the examples I use in terms of ritual to illustrate this is a game that we all know very well, and that is the game of hide-and-seek. Hide-and-seek is a game that we have all played. My children still play it. And hide-and-seek is a very simple ritualistic game. There's home plate, you know, and everybody tries to get back there, and everybody hides, and somebody goes, tries to find them, and you try to get back to home base, you know, before that person touches you or finds you. However, there are little different interpretations of this depending upon you know, how you play it. But it's a pretty simple, straightforward game. And most children play it fairly straightforward, ritualistically. The first characteristic of rituals is that they do not analyze. They assume. In hide and seek, for example, everyone knows the game. There are no instructions. There are no hymnals. There's no white paper handed out. This is how you play, you know? If clarities are made, they are made simply in the process of playing. There's no analysis. There's no talking the ritual to death. Now, I can give you an example of when I saw that happen, when my daughter was about 4 years old. She tends to be a fairly analytic person, always has been. And I don't want to presume that this is the difference between boys and girls, but I think it's probably the difference between boys and girls. I have two boys as well. I send my two boys out to play, and they just do it. They're like a herd of dogs. They just go from one thing to another. And they sometimes discuss and analyze the game, but they play. They engage in the game. They play basketball. They play kickball. They play all kinds of things. And you know, when they do fight, it's because they are kind of quibbling about the rules. But generally speaking, they simply play. Well, my daughter was playing with some neighborhood boys who wanted to play hide and seek. They just wanted to play. She wanted to give instructions. And you could see that she decided that she knew better and she wanted to explain this to everyone, how they're going to do it differently. And you know what the boys did? They went home. Because this is not how you do it. They didn't argue with her. They didn't fight with her. They just simply left. They voted with their feet. And I'm not sure she got the message, but I did observe that, and it was at a time when I was actually thinking through some of these things, and I noticed that. The second thing rituals don't do is they don't discourse. They don't discourse. They assert and they proclaim. In hide and seek, children don't sit there and discourse about the nature of risk, which is the core thing about hide and seek. They proclaim risk by playing the game. I mean, they engage in it. They act it out. I mean, if they were to sit there and discourse on it, it wouldn't work. Now, this is similar, but a little nuanced. Three, rituals don't explain in a didactic way, but they engage one in the process. Rituals pull you in. I mean, last night and this morning, we didn't talk about what we were doing. We did it. We just did it. Now, maybe some of us, as we did it, were analyzing what we did. And that's very hard not to do, especially when you do something like we do, where we're engaged in the process. You know, it's very hard for us not to go, oh, wow, look what's happening here, and analyzing it, instead of just doing it. But I think, you know, many of us have hopefully reached the point where we can just simply do it and not think about it, even though this is what we do for our livelihood. One of the ways in which I try to be able to simply worship is by memorizing it, or memorizing as much as I can. That way I'm not looking at texts, I'm not thinking about them as I look at them, I just simply do it. And I'm always trying to memorize new texts because things are always shifting a little bit. This is what I teach seminarians when they lead in worship. And one of the things that has become so clear to me in teaching Lutherans about how to preside at the liturgy is that we just don't feel comfortable doing it. I mean, I don't know what it is. It's not in our blood. I watch other denominations that are liturgical, like Roman Catholics, particularly Anglicans. They just seem so at home. And it takes our guys a while to feel at home, if they ever do. But one of the things that I suggest to them is that they memorize it. And they not only memorize the words, but they memorize the movement. You know, I know they used to laugh at me when I said, you always turn this way. You always turn to your this way. Always turn this way. You know, and they go, why? And I said, well, if you want to know the real reason, it doesn't obtain anymore for most places, and that's because the deacon was always on your right, and you never turned your back on the deacon. It was bad form. It was impolite. Now, why do we still do that? Well, there's really, in some ways, no reason. But I suggest to them that the reason they do that is so that they don't have to think about it anymore. They just do it. And that they do things at the altar so that there's a sense of naturalness and fluidity and a complete kind of unconsciousness about what they're doing. And the reason? So that they can worship. So that they feel so at home there, and this is so part of the very nature of who they are, that they don't have to be self-conscious about it. They don't have to be sitting there analyzing it. They can, as this says, engage in the process. They can experience it right in its very core. I mean, one of the things we shouldn't do as we worship is try and explain the effects of this worship upon our character. It just happens. It happens. And if it doesn't happen, then there's probably something wrong with the ritual. Fourth, rituals don't conceive, they perceive. Conception is rational, but perception is like the smell of perfume or great music done greatly. I always like to use those two examples because they are very sensual and they engage the entire being. It was delightful last night to be able to smell God and our prayers to Him. I don't know why we're so afraid of that. Smells bring associations that are profound. I remember when I first dated my wife, she wore a perfume of my old girlfriend. And it was awful. I was so confused. I didn't know where I was. And she had to stop because I couldn't handle that. I'm sure you're the same way. Most people are. Smells are just, you know, extraordinary explosions of meaning and memory. My grandmother's house. I mean, when I walked in there, I was in a whole world. A world that was absolutely the most wonderful, delightful world of any place that I knew. And when that smell hit me, I had this wonderful peace and comfort that came from that. And I found, visiting many of my shut-ins in the parish, they had the very same smell of their house. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it is. It's a generational smell. But I'd go into their homes, and it was like being with grandma. And I immediately, as a pastor, had that relationship with them. I can't explain it. I don't know what it is. My wife says it's Palmolive soap. I don't know if that's what it is. I don't. But it is extraordinary. And you have that. I mean, and I'm sure you have the same feelings. But this is what rituals do. You know, music is exactly the same sort of thing. When you hear something, and when it's done well, especially, it engages you in a way that nothing else can. And you don't find yourself reflecting on that. You just simply perceive. It was really wonderful last night to have a half hour to essentially pray, or at least to let your mind wander on the concerns, you know, as you listen to the music, and as those two things kind of came together. Now you, as musicians, probably are able to concentrate more and listen more carefully than I am. I'm not trained that way. I do some of that, but I find my mind wandering, and it's a wonderful time to let your mind dwell on the things that are of concern to you and to offer them in prayer at that time. It was absolutely wonderful. No words, just perception and the way in which that kind of wells up in you. Now, this is all part of what is going outside the Eucharist. Number five, rituals don't reflect reality. They enact it. They enact it. To enter the game of hide-and-seek, you've got to leave home plate. And when you do, you begin to perceive. You begin to play the game. And this is absolutely, fundamentally true in Lutheran worship or sacramental worship, because we in every way enact a reality. And that reality is the flesh of Christ that we run headlong into Sunday in and Sunday out. When the word is proclaimed, there is immediately this fleshly reality there for us to engage in. And we don't just simply talk about it. We enter it. We eat it. We hear it. It enters our ears and it fills our being, as we heard this morning in the sermon. When we feed it the Eucharist, it actually comes and dwells within us. In baptism, it washes us completely clean. It really is an extraordinary thing that this definition of ritual completely, totally ends in what we call the essence of what Lutheran liturgy is all about, Christian liturgy. Let me just conclude here with four vital functions that are served by the simplest of rituals. First of all, rituals will simplify for us. They will simplify. There is nothing more complex than God. We really can't, humanly speaking, understand Him. He has given us a means by which we can, through His revelation, and we as Christians use that revelation as we gather together in His presence. What rituals do help us to understand the complexity of what it is that God and all that He has done for us is. And when you see the pattern, when you see the rhythm, when you see the movement, and you actually boil it down, as I'm going to do in terms of the Liturgy of the Hours for you, it's very simple. There's nothing complicated here. This isn't rocket science. In fact, it's so simple that it is stunning in its simplicity. And in a world that is not only, complex and filled with all kinds of tensions and frustrations, one of the things that we do when we come together is to give ourselves that simple line of ritual that allows us to reorder ourselves. Rituals simplify, and they convince us of what is right by means of their simplicity. Secondly, they protect. I mean, this is certainly related to simplify, but they protect us against excess and arbitrariness. To be protected by ritual simply means to know that there is a place that we can go where we know what's going to happen. We have expectations, and we know that what's going to happen is going to be good. Now, it may make us feel bad for a while, but in that feeling bad, we will feel good. That's the tension of law and gospel, of confession and absolution, and the movement from finding out who we are and then finding out who He is and what He has made us in Him. And that protection is very important. There is something extraordinarily wonderful about entering into a sacred space that you are familiar with and that you can enter into and feel at home in. I feel that way very much about my space in Fort Wayne. It's a beautiful, magnificent space. And I sing in the choir and I sing in the back row right next to the organ. And that has become my spot. And I am most at home. I am most relaxed, most completely at peace when I am in that space. I am fully and totally protected. I can't wait to get there. And that's one of the reasons why I dislike the traveling, because I cannot worship in my space, because that's where I feel totally, completely protected. Three, the giving of cohesion. These are all interrelated, as you can see. But this is where we find meaning about who we are. I mean, certainly I am no way going to say that the church is a place of peace and harmony in this world. I mean, there certainly are tensions there. But hopefully during the liturgy, war doesn't break out. That there is a sense of community. There is a sense of a body that is being bound together there in Him, His body. And that is the thing that I try to focus on as I worship every Sunday. Is I try to focus on the fact that no matter what's happening, at the seminary, in the greater church, even in our local congregation, in my family, in the families around me, where there's all this chaos, this is where we are bound together. This is where I come to love my neighbor as myself, even my enemies. This is where I'm joined together with all the saints. This is where I remember them. This is where I am filled with their presence because of His presence. This is where I enter a community that is beyond this little community here in which I live, but is bound together with your communities, with everyone who is united in that flesh of Christ as He comes to us in His supper and in His word. That is cohesion like none other that there is. And I know that sometimes, you know, requires a tremendous amount of a suspension of, you know, our own perhaps rational take on reality, but that's exactly what faith calls us to do. And that's what the liturgy, in fact, proclaims to us, because it is Christ there who is binding us together in a cohesive unit. When we are cohering in this way, there are a number of things that happen because we are filled with this numinous presence. Things break out like affection and charity, joy and surprise, hope and faith. That can only come when people are gathered together around that kind of numinous presence, where there are gifts beyond compare that we see, we receive, we fully experience. What happens then in a coherent community like that is that there is integration. That's the fourth and final thing that that rituals do. They integrate us into a life, into a community, in which we are now able to say to the world, this is what we believe together. This is what we have come to be able to confess for the life of the world. And what ritual moves you to is something outside of yourself. It moves you to be able now, as community, integrated into a way of life, a way of thinking, a way of believing. It integrates you into a community in which you now are bold enough to share that confession, that life, with the world. You can't do that if you're not part of this community, or if you don't sense that there is even community there. You can only do that when you are integrated and you understand who you are together as a body. I mean, people talk an awful lot about mission, but mission's not going to happen until there is that kind of integration, where people are all essentially on the same page. They may have different nuances of that, don't get me wrong, but when they are there in that Sunday morning ritual, that Eucharistic liturgy, they understand who they are. They know their identity. They know what they have become in Christ, and they want all the world to know that. The community does. I hope that this has given you a glimpse of some of the things that are out there. I wish I could go on. One of my favorite things, and I was tempted to do it, but I decided not to, is to talk about an ontology of ritual behavior by Erik Erikson. Most people know him. He's done some wonderful work on ritual and life cycle, and how children go through a cycle of learning how to be ritualistic beings by means of the process they go through. And I encourage you to look at some of the stuff that he's done. The reason for this digression is to try and accent what primary theology is all about. And if you remember, I had described that the first task of primary theology is to discover the theology that is in your parish, and that is, in many ways, discovering the ritual. And some of it's pretty obvious, what hymn book they use, what worship book, you know, what songs they sing, that kind of thing. But as I mentioned before, much of it is hidden. The second task of anyone who is engaged in the ritual life of a congregation, after discovering that, they are then to work to shape that so it is centered in Christ. That is the center of Christian liturgy and ritual. I mean, that is the criteria by which, at least I believe, we should judge everything that goes on in worship. I like to use the Transfiguration as an example of this. The Transfiguration, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful illustration of what should be going on in our liturgy. I mean, think for a moment of what happens on the Mount. It is exactly what happens in the liturgy. Heaven and earth come together. They come together in this incredible moment. And there you have the Lord of creation in the flesh, but now transfigured. His glory is showing through. You've got Moses and Elijah who have come from heaven. And then you've got these three human beings, Peter, James, and John, who are in the world and of the world. And now they're all together on that mount. And in Luke's Gospel, and only Luke's Gospel, you have this extraordinary statement that what Moses, Elijah, and Jesus are talking about is Jesus' exodus, his departure, which he was about to fulfill in Jerusalem. Now, what in the world are they talking about, his exodus? Well, most scholars will tell you that this is that movement, okay, from suffering, death, into the grave, and then up on the third day and back into heaven. His movement in and out of this world. This is how he accomplishes our redemption, is through this journey, this exodus, this departure. And in fact, if you go back a little further, you can see that Jesus' exodus, his journey, is from heaven to heaven. You know, here the Creator of all things comes into our world and becomes a creature, conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, he's moving down, was crucified, died, and buried. That's the bottom. Buried in the tomb, right into the earth. From heaven, right into the belly of the earth. On the third day, he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven and sits at the right hand of the Father. He's back to heaven. And that's how he accomplished our redemption. He went through that whole process. I mean, and those of you who are familiar with the Easter Vigil and the Triduum and the catechetical life that Christians are now engaged in throughout the world, which I'm going to be talking about this afternoon, what we simply do in baptism is we just follow him in the journey. He did it before us. We go with him. Now that is what they're talking about, Moses and Elijah. And it's not like all of a sudden they got on earth and they looked at each other and they said, well, what should we talk about? They were carrying on this conversation in heaven. And when they came to earth, they just kept it going. It's the ongoing conversation. And I like to paraphrase it in the language of Revelation. This is the conversation about the Lamb who was slain and raised again. That is what we're going to be proclaiming forever in heaven. That is the song. The song is about the Lamb. I mean, that's what the book of Revelation, it seems to me, is about. And of course, that is what we should be doing in our word and song. We should be proclaiming that in some way or another. It should be Christological. I mean, that one hymn this morning ended, boom, right in Christ. It had its goal. I mean, it moved very nicely through all of creation, boom, to Christ. I mean, you could see that wonderful climax there. And having engaged in the ongoing conversation, we enter into the ongoing feast, you know, which is a foretaste, as we say, of the marriage feast of the Lamb and his kingdom, which has no end. Now, this is primary theology in its essence. And primary theology, I mean, we've talked about it as being the theology of the liturgy. It's the theology of heaven. There is no secondary theology in heaven. It's all pure primary because the source of all things, the one who has recreated us and restored us to himself, he is the complete, total experience of what we will be doing. And that's why I think our liturgy here below needs to reflect that. And so the second task is to shape that primary theology so that it is centered in Jesus Christ. And I think that all of us see how important that is in the way in which we shape what we do as those who prepare for that. One of the things that I think should be clear in this particular way of describing what we do on Sunday mornings is that this is an act of worship, not an act of education. Even though people will learn things and must learn things in order to worship, the goal here is not to teach. We're going to do a lot of it. We're going to do some proclaiming. But the goal is to be in communion with Him, to receive those gifts and then respond to those gifts. And that is why I want to talk about the act of corporate Christian worship as primary theology in these three different phases. The first phase is that there is an encounter between humankind and God. I mean, I just love that expression of one of my profs where he says, we run headlong into God. Boom. You know? And if you don't do that, then there's something wrong. And as we heard this morning, what it is that we run headlong into, first and foremost, and primarily, is His Word. And it is God who speaks. And when He speaks, He gives gifts. He gives gifts. That's what happens in that encounter, is that God is the one who gives. Secondly, having encountered God in His Word and in His meal, a change takes place in the community. We're transformed by the gifts. There's conversion that takes place. It's an ongoing conversion, an ongoing transformation, and it should happen every time we gather together. I don't know about you, but I think one of the things that is so moving about the liturgy is that it allows one to reflect about who one really is. And that's where you hope the sermon assists you in that, in the confession of sins and some of the hymnody. And when one can reflect about what one is really like by nature, then one can recognize the extraordinary transformation that's taking place. That is really what is the essence of how we respond to the gifts. That's the third thing, that there's an adjustment to this change, to this transformation. We respond to that. We respond. And believe it or not, that's what most people consider liturgy to be, the response. And in many ways, it is for us, in terms of what has happened to us because of what God gives, it is the most profound thing that we do. And we respond in all kinds of ways. We respond in primarily song. In our liturgy, and as Lutherans, we do a lot of singing, and that is because we have received these gifts. And when you receive a gift, you always respond. And to sing is to rejoice because the bridegroom is present. And you always sing when the bridegroom is present. And that's why music is what's the most perhaps profound way in which you respond. We do in other ways. We recite creeds. We say prayers. We do litanies. I mean, we do all kinds of other things too. But really, as Lutherans, we respond primarily in song, in the canticles, in the psalmody, in the hymns. Let me conclude this by giving you five characteristics of primary theology. And this will give me a jumping off point to go ahead. And I have forgotten how long I am allowed to speak. 9:50? 10? 10 o'clock? 9 o'clock? 10 o'clock? 10 o'clock? Does anyone have a schedule? It's 9:45 now. How long do we go? This is it. This is it. Okay. All right. Then this is it. We will pick this up tomorrow. Thank you.